Hey guys, if you want updates on our latest episodes, then be sure to subscribe to the Film Colossus podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen. Also, if you'd like to support the show and hear episodes ad-free, then subscribe to our Patreon page at patreon.com/filmcolossus.
The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
My name is Chris Lambert.
And my name is Travis Bean. And on today's episode, we discuss the deeper meaning of the behemoth known as Oppenheimer. As two people who aren't huge fans of Christopher Nolan, our discussion involves our fraught history with his films and what we believe holds Oppenheimer back.
Oppenheimer.
Don't say it three times.
No. Oh. Beetlejuice, gosh. Right? Don't need a Beetlejuice.
Yeah, you don't want to make it won't make an atomic bomb go off, but one will appear, you know, wherever you are.
Which would be frightening.
Yeah, it just sits there like it's defunct, but like it's annoying. Like you saw the one in Oppenheimer, it's huge.
Yeah, if I had to maneuver around that all the time.
Like you wouldn't be able to get it out of your house. It would just be a permanent fixture.
No, it would not fit through the door.
I mean, you couldn't even move it an inch.
I'd get strong, try to lift it, still couldn't.
Yeah. But no, you just forever be like Robert Oppenheimer / Cillian Murphy and wandering around listlessly thinking of what your life could have been.
If I just didn't have this atomic bomb in my house.
Yeah, I mean, it would pretty much consume you from that point forward. Like, it would be all you think about.
I get why.
You'd have to explain it to everybody.
Yeah. Hey, can we come over for a dinner party? No. I have an atomic bomb.
If you want to eat on my atomic bomb.
Yeah. I feel like the government would take interest in me.
Yeah, your life would change.
Not for the better. Not for the better, which, you know, we see happen in this movie about J. Mm-hmm. Robert Oppenheimer, directed by Christopher Nolan.
Yep. That's the guy. That's Mr. Nolan himself. Coming around the bend.
I wonder if he'd visit me.
How many years has it been since Tenet? It's like only been a couple years, right?
It's been, yeah, Tenet was 2020.
Okay. That seems about right for him. Like every 3 years, we get a Nolan venture.
Yeah, Dunkirk was... What year? Oh, Tenet's 2020. Yeah, Dunkirk was 2017. Interstellar was 2014.
Oh, wow. Wow, Interstellar. In my mind, Interstellar came out like forever ago, but that's not that long ago.
9 years. Then, Memento is 2000. Have you seen every Christopher Nolan movie?
I have. I sure have. I've only seen Following once, though. Probably like, you know, 13 years ago.
I've never seen Following.
Yeah, it's got quite the following. I think Criterion might have a release for Following. I'm not sure, but they had some write up about it on their blog.
I remember it was just a big deal because it premiered at Slamdance. Mm. So Slamdance is always like Christopher Nolan's one of ours.
Yeah.
Good for them. That's
what was the other movie I saw that premiered at Slamdance? There Will Be Blood. I saw. Did
wait? Really?
Yeah, in like September before it was released in December in like 12 theaters, which I was a part of. It released at Slamdance.
That's pretty insane.
Yeah, isn't it? Slamdance, is that the one? No, not Slamdance. What's the
Fantastic Fest?
My bad.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Very different sizes.
Yeah. No, Slamdance. That would be pretty crazy.
Yeah. You said September. I was like, wait a second.
Yeah.
Fantastic Fest makes sense. That would have been a huge get for them. One of their secret screenings.
I mean, yeah, Fantastic Fest is bigger than Slam Dance, but that seems really big for them.
Yeah, no, 1,000%. I think, especially because they tend to be so much more genre-oriented.
Yeah.
That getting something that's so dramatic.
Nice. It's got its horror moments.
It does. Same with, you know, actually, Oppenheimer had me thinking about There Will Be Blood quite a bit.
Oh, okay.
Specifically because Cillian Murphy felt like he was channeling Daniel Day-Lewis, his performance of Daniel Plainview. Just his speech pattern and how he was saying things had that same kind of Daniel Plainview delivery about it. And they have a similar body type. They were dressed kind of the same in terms of high pants and suspenders.
And a hat.
And a hat. So there was a decent amount of There Will Be Blood. Even like the Los Alamos part, they're building this town in the middle of nowhere. And you see the same thing kind of happen in There Will Be Blood. A town builds up around the oil derrick.
Plus, you know, Daniel Plainview is an intense woman's man, you know, a womanizer.
Oh, of course, of course. Everybody associates Daniel Plainview with his...
Always trying to get with some woman.
Yeah, that was his focus throughout that movie.
Yeah, oh, it was distracting, honestly.
I know, just focus on the oil. Jeez.
Ugh. Talk about greed in America already.
Why aren't you focused on that at all? Okay, were you excited for Oppenheimer? Was it one that... what's your relationship with Nolan's movies? You've seen all of them. Is that out of an enjoyment for Nolan, or is that just...
It's honestly a mixed bag. Like, people really, really love him. That's the way I've always, like, I felt kind of out of place in the Nolan verse. Like, people either really love him or really hate him. Although I think the crowd that hates him, like, isn't as big. I'm mostly just thinking of people I know, maybe. But I've always kind of felt like he's not necessarily my kind of director visually, like the way he visually approaches his subjects and the way he explores what's going on with them. Like, I've never, like, I don't think a lot of his movies are bad, but I've never been a fan of movies like Memento or Insomnia or Interstellar. And then, or I would say more Dunkirk. And then there are movies I flat out don't like Interstellar and The Dark Knight Rises. I've never understood this Prestige either. But I've just been in this middle ground where, like, it's not for me, but, like, it's not objectively bad or anything. He's just, like, not in the region I'm looking for, like, the kind of movie, the kind of approach to visual storytelling that moves me. We can get into more what I mean by that specifically as we talk about Oppenheimer. It's kind of weird. Like, I don't mind watching his movies and sometimes really enjoy it. Like, I really like Batman Begins. I really enjoy Tenet and Inception. I think Inception actually is incredible. For reasons outside of, what we'll talk about with Oppenheimer. But yeah, so like my relationship has been kind of like in flux in that way. Like, sometimes I like it, sometimes I really hate it. For the most part, I am sort of indifferent towards it.
I've been in a similar boat. I remember when Batman Begins came out. That was the first Nolan movie I watched. I had it caught. Memento, missed Insomnia. So Batman Begins, I remember just kind of being in love with when it came out, especially since I hadn't liked... Batman and Robin, was it?
Oh, you're breaking my heart, Chris.
I never remember which is the fourth one and which is the third one.
Batman and Robin is the fourth one.
Okay, yeah. I know you love it, but
I love all of the 90s Batman movies.
Yeah, I did not. So seeing Batman Begins, I was just like, this is what it could be. Oh my goodness.
I enjoy Batman Begins.
And it was so many good things in it. And then when The Prestige came out, I was the person running around being like, have you seen The Prestige? Have you seen The Prestige? Oh my God, Christopher Nolan, The Prestige, The Prestige, The Prestige.
Yeah, 2006, that was the year I started college, and like every freshman boy on my dorm room floor loved Prestige, you know? I hadn't seen it back then, but like it was that kind of movie.
Yeah, it it definitely had its moments. And then, it was Prestige and The Illusionist coming out at the same time.
Oh, yeah, of course.
I didn't see The Illusionist until a couple years later, and I think I kind of liked it better.
Oh, wow.
In hindsight, but I have to rewatch them. The Dark Knight, then, I really had loved as well.
Oh, yeah.
It was just like, Nolan can't miss. And then Inception was the same thing. I was there opening night. I saw it like three times in the first weekend. Because I went and saw it by myself, then went and took my mom to see it, and then went with friends to see it. She was like, you have to see this movie. I'm just staring at everybody.
It was a moment, like for theaters and stuff. I remember going to see it.
Oh, yeah. It was huge. And I was so excited to see people react to the top at the end. Instead of watching the screen, I'm watching them, just watching their faces like, no, no, no. But... That was the last time I enjoyed a Nolan movie. So it's been 13 years, and Dark Knight Rises I thought was actively stupid, and started to show the worst qualities of Nolan, in that he's the thing that bothers me the most, and this is why I'm most excited to do this podcast episode, because I just have wanted to talk about this one thing that Nolan does. That infuriates me. It's not objectively bad or anything. It's not. It's just he cross-cuts under this pulsing building score that makes you feel like something significant is happening because of the energy of the cross-cut, because of the score. And usually it's when just very boring things are happening. But because he's cutting between like two to three different storylines or characters doing things, and it's all feeling like it's coming together, it has this manipulating effect of feeling more momentous.
This is momentous.
Yeah, than it actually is. And he's really a master at what is going to cause an audience to pop. In wrestling, whenever a wrestler in a match does something that's like a big move or something, it's like it's designed to get a pop from the crowd. Like, you know you're going to get the audience to react. And I think Nolan is so good at doing these little setups and payoffs that have people being like, oh, yeah, that's the stuff. That was just so well done, like perfectly timed. There's two moments in Oppenheimer specifically that are some of people's favorite moments in the movie. And I get why, but I feel so nakedly manipulated by them that I hate them. So it's. Dark Knight Rises, I think, was the first time I really noticed him do it as a crutch. Like, Inception, he's doing it really well, and I think it's the perfect... It's Nolan at his finest.
I agree. But
then Dark Knight Rises is him phoning it in, because at that point, he didn't care, right? And doing
Is that true?
I think it's true. I don't know if it's true or not. Maybe he really still cared, but... there's that one scene where... Bane robs a bank and they go running out and it's like broad daylight, and then when Batman goes chasing him on his motorcycle, it's nighttime. You're like, was he, what happened here?
Well, it was dusk.
Was it dusk?
I don't know.
Maybe that's it, but it's still such a like what. But I noticed it with Interstellar too, and Interstellar also did a lot of manipulative things that didn't sit well with me, that I was really like angry at it. Same thing with Dunkirk, same thing with Tenet, not so much. Tenet, I just didn't
Tenet
think was...
does feel like a different movie for him.
Yeah.
Which we'll talk about. Like, the reason I think Inception and Tenet really work is largely absent in a lot of the other movies I think don't work, including Oppenheimer.
I think I just expected more from Tenet, where Tenet is... like mostly it didn't annoy me the same way that Interstellar and Dunkirk did. I just didn't love it the way that I loved Inception or The Prestige or Dark Knight, Batman Begins.
Right.
And then Oppenheimer is another where I think I'm angrier at the response to Oppenheimer than I
Chris,
am.
This is my life.
Yeah.
I feel like I'm constantly like I don't even hate a movie for like the way it is. Like, I end up not liking a movie because I'm just so pissed at the way everybody's like talking about it and renouncing it and everything.
Well, yeah, the new Twitter account that I've been using, I follow all these film critics.
Yeah.
And so the timeline's just full of people really like trying to deliver on like not just like a viral tweet, but really, and I don't want to say performative in a bad way, but it's just like, you know, they know that they have an audience. They're speaking to the audience, to the crowd about the movie, but it just feels like there's so much hyperbole in a lot of it, of like, this is a masterpiece where the last look is the most existential and haunting thing I've ever seen on a cinema screen.
The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Welcome to Fail Better, David Duchovny's new podcast with Lemonada Media. On Fail Better, David, who has experienced both low and high-profile failures throughout his life, explores the vast world of failure, how it holds us back, propels us forward, and ultimately shapes our lives. Each week, he'll chat with guests like Ben Stiller, Bette Midler, and more about how our perceived failures have actually been our biggest catalysts for growth, revelation, and even healing. Through these conversations, he hopes listeners can learn how to embrace the opportunity of failure and fail better together. Fail Better is out now wherever you get your podcasts. CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Okay.
Yeah. So like maybe that explains partly why like I don't necessarily hate Oppenheimer or anything, and maybe if I was more clued into the way people are reacting to it, I could be, but like I'm largely removed from social media at this point, and I honestly couldn't tell you like what its Rotten Tomato score is. I'm sure it's high, but like I have no concept of it anymore. Like I'm just here to watch Oppenheimer and judge it accordingly.
That's good. That's good. Yeah. You also did not enjoy it, I'm guessing.
It's in line with what I said earlier. It's not my kind of movie. Like, I don't think it's bad, but I think it's a huge letdown from what he did in Tenet. Like, I guess getting into it now, like, the things I think really work here, what I think doesn't work in a Nolan movie is when he becomes a little too consumed with the person. Like when he's really trying to explore the internal landscape in a literal sense. Like it's just a lot of like talking and like you're describing, like even though you see it as a fault, like I would say one of his strengths is the fact that he's able to make boring things appear exciting. I only say strength because like it's better than just like watching people talk monotonously for minutes on end and like nothing to be happening. Like, okay, at least he's like doing something. I don't necessarily care for that kind of filmmaking, but like I see how it works and I see how that gets people, you know, like jazzed when they're watching it. So like, I think that's a good thing. But because he spends so much time in that arena and because he does, again, very literal things, like when the screen shakes, when Oppenheimer's being questioned by the guy, you know, or when he's giving the speech to everybody and they're stomping their feet and it makes him think of like the bomb. Like Nolan's being so literal there with his imagery and like showing like the blinding light and the shaking room and the people's skin coming off. It's such a obvious choice. Or like when what's Florence Pugh's character?
Tatlock.
Yeah, like when they're having sex in front of Kitty, you know, and she's imagining it, like it's so obvious, which like, again, not my favorite kind of thing, but like I get why it works. It's just a little bit too much of that throughout a lot of his movies to me. Like, I don't know why he loves boring conversations so much. It's so ever-present in his movies. But people like it. And he's got good actors, so, like, whatever. It's not unbearable or anything. But I think what makes something like Inception and Tenet thrive is, like, that's not really the focus in those movies. Like, he's more focused on this insane world he's invented and explaining, well, in Inception's case, explaining all the rules. And in Tenet, I feel like he doesn't explain all the rules. Like, there are moments where he pretends to explain the rules, but then just, like, leaves out, like, all these bits of information that would make it make way more sense. Like, to me, like, that's his wheelhouse. Like, that's when all of that stuff maneuvering around the characters tells me so much more about the characters than the kind of stuff he's doing in Oppenheimer, you know? Like, I don't think I'm really getting to know Oppenheimer by just watching him talk to a bunch of people. Like, I need more. It doesn't feel intrusive to me, I guess. Like, I'm just watching it. Like, it's just a glorified history retelling, like a reenactment or something. And in that sense, like, I'm watching it. Like, I get it. It's cool that I'm learning all this stuff. But it's also just a little too plain for me.
Yeah. Yeah, there was a lot. I think the thing, so I was excited for this movie just because it seemed like it was going to be this epic event at scale. Like, it seemed like something that if Nolan was going to rise to the occasion, this mm-hmm. would be the kind of thing that really could be his masterwork, and maybe it's the thing that I've been looking for from him. And then I was reading him talk about all the subjectivity he was going to bring into the movie and how there are black mm-hmm. and white parts that were objective, and he had written the script in the first person, so we're really getting into Oppenheimer's mind mm-hmm. and seeing the world through his eyes. And it's funny that there was this hype about that. And then, as you're saying, do we really get to understand Oppenheimer as a character or as a person? He feels like such an empty vessel for so much of the movie.
Yeah, I think we're kind of getting at the main problem is here is that Nolan's never had a case like this where he is trying to unlock somebody so specific. Like, somebody really well known, like movie like Inception, Leonardo DiCaprio's character is a vessel for this universal struggle, you know, the struggle with grief and trauma and understanding and being able to differentiate between like dream and reality. Like, there are all of these like universal truths happening in that movie. Whereas this to me falls in line with a lot of what of his other movies are, like why I personally have never loved something like The Dark Knight, because like it is making societal observations, but they don't feel overbearing in the way like Inception is. It feels more aligned with Oppenheimer, where like I'm just kind of getting to know like one person or one aspect of something instead of being catapulted into something and having to navigate like all of these rules and ideas surrounding a person. Feeling engulfed by all of it. Like, instead, like, I think the main plight of this movie is like to just, it happened, like, it's all built to the end of like, how do you see it, Oppenheimer? Like, how do we remember people like this? Like, what history do we trust? There are these bigger questions that like are only kind of really brought in at the very end. And before that, like, we're literally just learning about a guy. Like, it feels as simple and straightforward as that to me.
Yeah. I mean, the first hour and a half of the movie, I don't know if it's really, I mean, we're establishing some of the governmental aspects, the tension between, I mean, government is such a big theme in this, and the way in which Oppenheimer was appealing towards these leftist politics, but then falls in line to the U.S. government, and we see the way in which the U.S. government ends up tearing him apart. Like, seeds are being planted. So I don't want to say the first hour and a half is not doing anything, but I saw somebody say that the movie's like reading a Wikipedia article, and that kind of
It is.
Felt right to me, except the point that they made was if you actually read the Oppenheimer Wikipedia entry, it's a lot more interesting than the movie because you learn so much more about the idiosyncrasies of Oppenheimer and the way in which he liked to hold court and his personality and the magnetic nature. And I think Cillian Murphy did a great job the role. It's just I don't think Nolan's script gave him enough to do. I don't think he gave anybody enough to do aside from Robert Downey Jr. I think Robert Downey is the only one that had meaningful scenes that he could really like dive into and a character arc.
yeah it's odd. Like I feel like that's the tension of the movie, is that like it's ostensibly this deep character study, but like I guess one main thing I couldn't get around was like I feel like the dilemma presented surrounding Oppenheimer and the way we're supposed to feel about him, and then what the movie's ultimate question is, like it's the question that leaves of people leaving the theater, like it's kind of set up immediately. Like we're immediately supposed to like kind of question like the nature of his character and the decisions he makes, and like is this the kind of guy you can trust? Like is this the kind of guy that will go down in history as like misremembered, or like is somebody who like was this kind of guy and invented something terrible? Like it's just that question throughout, and the question you're left with at the end. And that's a great formula, a great structure for a movie, but it's a 3-hour movie. Like, and for 3 hours, like I'm not sure how much that question gains complexity. It's like I guess it all just, again, feels inherent to me, like that dilemma. And I don't know if Nolan is the kind of filmmaker that can bring enough pizzazz and like interesting visual moments to give that question the kind of complexity he's looking for. Again, like the only moments it really happens are like when the room shakes or when Katie sees Tatlock. Like it's just all this stuff. I'm like, yeah, I get it. Like, I know what you're doing. Like, I see like what you're going for, but it's not like, I guess this is purely subjective. It's just not shaking me enough to care about that overbearing question more.
No, and the movie seems to essentially make Oppenheimer pretty sympathetic in the way in which, okay, he had fears about the Nazis, went into this project, and then felt compelled to complete it, even when he had doubts and questions because he's swept up in things. But look, he spent the remainder of his life fighting against it, and the government squashed him from daring to stand up. And the like, Nolan seems to make a pretty clear case to me about, see, is it Oppenheimer a little more positive than negative, don't you think? And I do like that there are themes of chain reactions. And then you have in that final conversation with Einstein, the water droplets hitting the pond, or the rain hitting the pond, causing these chain reaction ripple effects. So that's a nice, I think it's the one moment of pure, it's visual.
Yeah.
That I can point to and be like, see, that's a little more subtle.
Man, I was about to say, like, I don't think it's subtle at all. Like, it would be subtle, I feel like, of somebody else. But there's something about the way, like, Nolan chooses to make little connections like that that feel like, oh my God, I get it. Like, maybe it's even just the way he shoots it. Like, he has this fear, and this is just something that, again, I'm just mostly focused on the visual nature of Nolan. Like, there's something about the way he shoots movies that just doesn't speak to me at all. There's almost like a cold detachment about the way he just frames everything the same way. It's a big part of why I can't get in the Memento, is just the way it's shot. It feels just so obvious and plain to me in a way, like, I can't... It's weirdly, like, unique to Nolan, and something I hope no other filmmaker adopts as like a way of shooting a movie.
Which is fascinating because his cinematographer for his last few projects is Hoyt Van Hoytema.
Mm-hmm.
And this guy did Oppenheimer, Tenet, Dunkirk, Interstellar. But he did Nope, which Nope was dope in terms of its visuals. Ad Astra was also incredibly beautiful.
Yeah, that was awesome.
And Her. And Her has incredible, incredible cinematography. And then Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy was also, I thought, it's a lot more Nolan-y and it's like distance and coldness. But I thought that was a very compelling movie. Yeah. So it's not like the cinematographer in question that Nolan's working with is incapable of going play. I would say like most of the shots in Her are better than most everything in Nolan's filmography.
I mean, I'm sure there's somebody out there that could point to all of the technical things Nolan does in a movie that I wouldn't notice and don't understand, like the lighting and just like the way people are populated around a scene or something, which I'm sure is true. I guess maybe this is just speaking to more my taste and like what I'm looking for in a movie. Like, I really want something to pop. Like, I really want something to kind of shake me and like make me think about something or make me look at something and speak to like what the larger themes and ideas are. And like, I just feel like Nolan is constantly not doing that. And the moment I know he is doing it, it's like the raindrops where I'm like, yeah, okay, I get it. Like, yeah. I don't know. There's something like he never finds the right amount of subtlety, mix of subtlety and just like flash that I'm looking for.
Well, it was particularly jarring going from this to Barbie in the same day with only an hour between them. And just seeing the way in which Greta Gerwig has close-ups of things. Like, there's a close-up of an eye or the close-up of Barbie's lips parting when she experiences what it's like to be human, or hands touching. I feel like that's just an underutilized shot in Nolan's visual vocabulary. You don't see a lot of these close-ups. And it's not to say directors have to. It's just when I look at the vocabulary that other filmmakers are using in their visuals, whether it's Gerwig and Barbie or just, you know, Villeneuve and Dune, and how much more texture and life there is. And I would say that not Oppenheimer, but there's something similar between Nolan and David Fincher's more procedural films.
Right.
I don't think what Fincher does in Zodiac is all that different from the aesthetic that's at the core of what Nolan does. But there's such a dramatic difference in the charge and the quality of the shots in Zodiac compared to any Nolan movie, where I think what gives Nolan that sense of spectacle is often the actual thing that's being depicted being so extreme. Like, not everybody gets to depict an atomic bomb going off. Not everybody gets to depict Tenet and this reverse entropy that's happening, or Inception. And even going back and watching Inception, the big moments feel kind of small now that we're so many years on. The city folding is like 45 seconds of the movie.
Yeah.
Or Limbo. When you look at Limbo, it's really underdeveloped and cookie cutter, that all the buildings are kind of the same. And you do get this sense of this crazy epic Limbo city, but it's never really explored in a meaningful way. And Interstellar, again, it's this big space graphics and you have the giant wave on the one planet, but that's kind of it. You have these moments that pop, but for the most part, I don't think what he does is visually interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. The whole time you were talking about David Fincher, like, I hurt my neck because I was nodding so much. Like, because when I talked about that cold detachment I see in a Nolan movie, like, Fincher is instantly the other person I think of. And Zodiac is a great example where, which I think is a weird style he's kind of gravitated towards. Like, I would say something like Fight Club or Seven, like, it's a little more electric, but something like Zodiac feels more in line with what he's done lately, where there's like a stature to the way he's filming his scenes, yet there is that kind of coldness. And part of that is the filter he kind of has on his movies, like this like pale blue grayish tone. But like that, everything I just said right there, like pale blue grayish tone, like that's something, like that's something that enlivens me, and I see it, like even if I don't like the movie, like I'm not a fan of Gone Girl, like I have to recognize that like it has presence. Like there is a visual voice there that's kind of commanding me and guiding me in a certain direction, and that I never really feel with Oppenheimer. Like by the movie's end, I'm able to look back and be like, okay, I see what this movie's doing. I'm seeing the questions it's asking. But while the movie's going, I don't feel emotionally attached to any of those questions or ideas. I don't feel that the movie is visually exploring those ideas in a like connected way. Like I can go back and piece the moments together, like the raindrops. But like while it's happening, I'm not moved. I'm looking to be moved, you know?
Yeah. I think a lot of the perceived power of the Nolan movie is just in the cross cutting and that sense of build. And then when you do have those moments of payoff, it either makes the movie worth it or the scene worth it, or you feel satisfied. Like I thought the bomb drop was interesting, but I didn't think it was compelling.
I mean, I was blown away by that scene, that it like, that's what the movie was sold around. Like that was the reason I purchased an IMAX ticket, was to see this bomb drop. And it's like a minute of the movie in a 3-hour movie filled of talking. Like I was really blown away. Even all the
in a
the
bad
shots,
way, right?
Yeah, in a bad way. Yeah. Like it was cool, I guess, but it didn't have the, pardon the pun, explosion I was really looking for. Like it didn't. Even the scenes where it was like, you know, all the lights and particles and everything floating around, like I saw people on Twitter talking about how amazing those scenes were, and they felt those scenes had the same cold detachment I never respond to in Nolan movies. They just felt like another scene where people are talking to me. Like they didn't have like tenor and power and like illustriousness. Like there was nothing, they just kind of felt thrown in. I guess like they didn't feel part of a build or part of a message. I guess maybe I'm just not watching these movies the way other people are watching them.
No, that disappointed me so much, because when it first, like first 20 minutes of the movie, when we're seeing stuff like that, I was like, oh, we're really going to like dive in and maybe we're going to get this internalization or see his view on these things throughout. Like it's going to be sparking. Maybe we're going to see like a dovetail of how he's viewing the world is in particles, and you know, how is this going to mess with the visuals of the film? And instead it's just done in the most basic way possible of having these brief cutscenes or cuts to like physics. And they look cool, but they're so quick, they don't really add anything. We're not seeing the way in which he's putting together ideas or a concept in any way. It's just affectation, mm-hmm, or decoration. And I mean, you look at the Tree of Life, and the Tree of Life has some similar things with its formation of the universe sequence,
right?
Oof. But it's
comparing it to Tree of Life really points out how how limp this movie is,
right? It's like so minor league. I mean, it looks good, like it's sure, looks good because it's expensive, but compare it to the sequence in Tree of Life, and there's so much more vitality and dynamics and heft to it rather than it just being a decoration.
Yeah.
I was really disappointed with how that went, especially that it didn't really dovetail with the bomb test. You mm-hmm think that would have been a logical point to bring those things together and this vision that he's been having and the way in which it's now being realized. It just showed to me, I don't want to say that Nolan lacks vision, but I think Nolan lacks vision.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app today to get free delivery on your first three orders, while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Well, it's just like all these things we're talking about, though, these should all be contributing towards understanding of Oppenheimer and what's plaguing him. And whatever's plaguing Oppenheimer should, it shouldn't just be a biopic where we learn about a guy. Like, these questions should be then parallel into our own lives. Like, Oppenheimer has to sit there and deal with the cognitive dissonance of creating a bomb. And obviously, like, we can't relate to that specific thing, but like, that exaggerated example, you can apply to any area of your life where you felt torn, where you look back and wonder if like what you did was right or wrong. And you piece all the parts of your life together that led to this moment, and like, you think about your life more collectively. Like, all that should be happening, but this lack of visual presence that we're talking about, that I, again, a lot of people seem to see in his movies, but we don't, like, to me, is what's holding me back. It's, it makes, I mean, to put it plainly, I just think his movies aren't fun. Like, they should be more fun in that sense. Not a movie about a bomb should be fun in quotes, but it, thinking about like something as simple as like Robert Downey Jr.'s turn in the movie, you know, Strauss's turn, where like you suddenly realize like, oh, he's kind of secretly a bad guy. It's done in this like very like, I keep going back to the cold detached thing, like a cold detached way, like you just like, you just find out and that's it. Like, it isn't done with like a sense of humor, like a sense of fun, like just suddenly this guy who's his aide suddenly like gives him sneering looks and smiles secretly when like he's taken down, you know, when Hill takes him down. Like, it's just like all this really obvious plain stuff that isn't part of the visual poetry of the movie, in a way that I'm like, I can't parallel things that are happening with Oppenheimer and the events of this movie with myself and the world I live in. Like, that's not where I go. Like, the movie isn't shaking me to do that. It's only afterwards, when I think about it and when we're doing this podcast, that I'm able to like see all those pieces, I guess. Which makes the movie feel like robotic to me in that way. Like, I wasn't shaken by it. I'm just like understanding it later technically.
There's so many things I want to get into with what you just said. The first, and it's the, okay. First, I just want to point out the difference in the subjective, because people keep making a big deal of the subjectives, and specifically as you're talking about the one scene of the speech in the aftermath of the Trinity test and everybody cheering, but he's seeing these horrible things, which seems to be the ultimate expression of this subjectivity that we see in the movie. It's that, and then when he's getting pressured during the hearing. But then also, weirdly, what you said with Kitty seeing Gene Tatlock sleeping with him in the room, why are we suddenly from her perspective?
It was weird.
Or is it supposed to be that Oppenheimer's thinking about his wife, thinking about him sleeping with Gene? It's strange that in a movie that was so from his perspective that they break at that one point. But I've been very interested lately in the use of the subjective in film, mostly due to Tar and the way in which Tar utilized that with the presence of a ghost in the movie and screams when she's out running that might not be there, like dogs in apartment complexes that might not be there. The way in which it walks the line between what we're seeing is real and what we're seeing is subjective through the main character having this nervous breakdown or this grief that's starting to cause her a degree of paranoia. was very subtle and very fascinating. And it's something that I become very excited about more filmmakers exploring. And it's just, again, disappointing to me how Nolan executes on it. But when you're talking about the relatable themes, I think the theme that I find the most fascinating in this movie goes back to the, the Bhagavad Gita. And the story of Vishnu talking to Arjuna. And there's the famous quote from Oppenheimer, like, you know, took on its multi-armed form. Now I become death, destroyer of worlds. And I researched that more deeply for the first time. And there's this cool dynamic in the fact that the story is about the fact that Arjuna is this prince that is supposed to lead his people into this war with these other people. Except he doesn't want to. It's just before the battle, and he sees in the enemy lines friends and family of his. Mm-hmm. So it's not just these enemies, it's people he knows and loves, and he's more willing to go and give himself up and have that end the conflict than to actually engage in the conflict. And his chariot driver is this god in disguise, and starts lecturing him that, no, you need to do your duty. It's your duty to lead this war. And then finally takes on the multi-armed form and is like, hey, this is me speaking now. Like, it's not your chariot driver. I'm, you know, Vishnu, the god. So I'm going to tell you these things about why you need to do this as it relates to duty, karma, reincarnation, the way in which gods work, that it's not actually you doing the killing. It's us decreeing that these things happen, and you're just the mechanism by which we're doing it. So you're not guilty. It's okay, but we need you to do this thing. And it's actually a good thing that you follow your duty and yada, yada, yada. And it goes on and on and on. And finally, Arjuna's like, cool. Okay, got it. And goes and wins the battle. But that sense of duty and the way in which I think people often apply that quote to thinking Oppenheimer was the one who had become death, but really Oppenheimer's Arjuna, the one that is bound by duty to do this thing. And it's like the United States is the god that's making this demand. And where Arjuna had faith in their god, can we have the same faith in our country and in our government officials, especially when Strauss is the embodiment of those officials? Right. That's really cool to me. But does the movie earn all of that aside from just making the reference?
Now, when it's a 3-hour movie filled with people talking.
Yeah, like, you really only get that idea of duty and the how much that weighed on him when Rob is yelling at him and he's like, so if we had asked you to build a hydrogen bomb, you would have. And he's like, I did my duty, and like yells. But then that's it. It doesn't. There's no reaction to it. There's no payoff to it. There's no nothing in the aftermath of it. And like, does it matter if he has a security clearance? I don't know.
Like, maybe we're just ultimately, this is what I've been trying to ultimately get at the whole time. When I think about the scene where like the room's shaking, or the moment where Gene is having sex with Oppenheimer in front of Kitty, like all those scenes like could work in a movie with a different visual language. Like, there's something like haunting and weird and gross about like Kitty sitting there watching his husband have sex with this other woman. Like, that to me, like, that's a cool scene. Like, that could have like so much power and have like a tongue-in-cheek nature, or give the movie a little bit of sleaze, you know? But like, that's not really the tone of the movie. That's not, that we don't see that happen multiple times. It isn't like a constant or anything. It's just a random thing thrown into a largely stalely filmed film. I just like, I'm looking for something a little bit more from him. And in this sense, like, it's why I feel so removed and confused about Nolan fandom, is like, I wonder where it is in a visual sense. Maybe it really has nothing to do with the visuals. Like, maybe people are just fascinated by all of the ideas explored in a Nolan film, which I agree. Like, there are a lot of things to talk about ideologically from any Nolan movie, but I guess I feel that way about like every movie. Like, I feel like every movie offers like all these questions we could ask ourselves, and I've never I need the visual element to guide me and like fascinate me about those questions in a way I'm just not getting. So in that sense, I just like, you know, I've just never really got it.
No. Well, and you mentioned how interesting the kitty moment could have been. What's hilarious to me is that they have that moment at that time and she's kind of angry with him.
Mm-hmm.
Because he's talking about what happened with Jean. And when he goes over, he's like, are you mad? We discussed this.
Yeah.
Like a decade ago. And it's like, yeah, wait, is that, I mean, maybe that's accurate. Maybe it's in the transcripts and, you know, that's part of the story. She was still hurt about it, but it's also such a strange thing because we know so little about Kitty because Nolan is really bad with female characters in general. And that's not to say like every movie needs to explore both genders equally, but Nolan specifically throughout his filmography has had a lot of criticisms about the way in which female characters aren't often developed, mm-hmm. and are typically just kind of there.
Yeah.
And this movie in particular, it's horribly bad. We don't learn anything about Jean Tatlock aside from her not wanting to date Oppenheimer, but also missing him and then taking her life because she was so broken up about him. So fine, it's from Oppenheimer's perspective. You know, mm-hmm. we're not going to know a lot about her. But we also didn't really get a lot from how much he cared about Jean to the point where he goes and has the mental breakdown that he has. And even his like breakdown, which is supposed to be this low point for him, lasts what, 30 seconds, 45 seconds?
Get back to making that bomb.
Yeah. And then you have Kitty come back, and Kitty, it seemed at one point, was going through postpartum depression, or at least just struggling with being a new mom and her husband gone all the time. So we see her go from this kind of bubbly socialite to, and I know she was supposed to be this very smart person who just ended up not necessarily having a career, but obviously was intelligent enough to be a partner to Oppenheimer. But we don't see what's plaguing her when she's having her drinking issues and they give up their kid for a little bit.
Mm.
Like, that's a huge thing. And yet we never hear her reason for it, if she's okay with it, if she's better in the aftermath of it. And then they get their kids back and we don't really know if she's okay with it, upset with it. When she's in Los Alamos, we don't really know anything about her day to day. Is she making friends? Is she still like postpartum? Is she depressed for other reasons? When she finds out about Kitty, is she angry with him, supportive of him? Does she just hold it in because she's doing something because she knows how big of a job he's undertaking and doesn't want to put extra pressure on him, and then she's resentful later? Like, what's the deal with their relationship? The movie just never gets into it and then gives her this moment where she tears apart the prosecutor at the hearing. And that's the thing I was talking about with Nolan having these wins or these pops. He sets that up where you have the one character be like, can we trust her to go in there and be okay? And Oppenheimer's like, yeah, of course. Like, I have full faith in her. So you have this question set up of like, is she going to do good? Is she going to do bad? And she's a little nervous at the beginning. And it seems like, oh, no, she's going to do bad. And then she finds her like footing and tears the guy apart. And we see her rise to the occasion. And it's this moment of like, oh, look, she's beating the bad guy back. And she had told him to stand up for himself, but he hadn't, and now she is. That's her win. But who the hell is, like, is she as a character, and what's this mean for her? And like, was she getting a lot of shit from other people and that's why she wanted him to fight? Was she reading a lot of negative press? Is it just a pride thing? Has she been this prideful the whole time? There's so much unexplored that would go into making that moment truly great. But instead, it's superficial and only feels good because of the structure around it, not because of the characters and us caring about the characters and rooting for the characters and what this moment means for them.
Yeah, that's like a classic Nolan thing to do, like those little wins. Like, he does it, I feel like he does it several times in this movie. Like, Oppenheimer is like such an asshole to Hill. Both times he sees him, he like knocks a pin out of his hand.
Yeah.
And in the end, you think like, oh, Hill's gonna say bad things about Oppenheimer. No, he saves Oppenheimer. It's just like, every time I see something like that in the Nolan movie, I'm like, okay. Or what was the other one?
The aide.
Yeah, there's the aide, and there's just somebody, I guess Kitty is the other big one. But I agree with you that if you're gonna set up these big moments, like there needs to be more foundation for it. I don't necessarily need everything you were talking about, like the way they're exploring Kitty. I actually think everything Nolan does is just fine. Like the little snippets he's given us of her and their relationship, like that clues me in enough to like what the nature of their relationship is, that like I get the impact the moment has like that. For me, the problem is, going back to it, the way all of this is presented visually. Like I just like the scene where Kitty is suddenly an alcoholic, which, side note, every time Kitty was on screen in this movie and had a drink in her hand, I just like started laughing. I thought it was so funny that was like the only quirk he could give this woman, is like, she's always drunk. But anyway, that scene where he comes home and like she's drinking, and like that is the impetus of like her drinking, ostensibly, that like she can't handle this life. I relate that to like these other moments in the movie I've talked about, where like she sees Gene and Oppenheimer having sex. Like, it has no presence. Like, it's not traumatic enough for me. Like, it feels like I'm just watching a theater scene from afar. Like, if all of those moments had more impact and were pulling me in a little bit more, like I might actually like feel something in that moment where Kitty gives it to the prosecutor at the end of the movie. But like, because all of those elements aren't there, this is like the Chris and Travis approach here combined in the one. Like, you're looking for like all of the background and character work, and like you need it, the movie, to dive into like the person in a way. And I need the movie to like present her situation in a visual sense, to like bring some like emotional clarity to everything in just like a sonic way. Yet both of these things aren't happening, and because of that, like I don't know how a moment like this lands at all.
Just because of the setup and the yes. superficial nature of him setting up the idea of will she or won't she?
Yes.
And that's enough for the audience reaction. And because Emily Blunt does a really good job in the time she has on screen, and the delivery there is so good, it's like, if you were just to show someone that speech out of context, they'd probably be like, that's cool. Like, I'm sure it's earned and awesome when you watch the movie. And it's like, no, it's not. But it's the same thing with the aide. Like, the aide, had it shown, had almost zero personality and zero context. Had he worked with Strauss before? Is he just with him for this process? That seems to be the case. Okay. Does he like Strauss? Does he dislike Strauss? Does it care either way? Does he like Oppenheimer? Does he not? Like, we don't need to know these things. But when the character at the end is the one delivering this snarky line, that's kind of pro, he defends Oppenheimer one time, and then at the end is like, maybe they were talking about something more important than you.
Yeah.
And you're like, why?
Why? How do you feel this way after like, after no time at all, basically?
Right. Was it just this guy was such a dick in the 24 hours or the 10 hours that you knew him that you feel like gloating like this? Are you just a dick? And this is how you.
That was the other thing. Like,
did you grow up an Oppenheimer fan? Yeah.
Like, the whole thing with Robert Downey Jr., I think that was the other thing I was starting to think of, like the turn he has. It's revealed that like the aide is pissed and feels slighted because like Robert Downey Jr. knew the whole time. Like, he's been one step ahead of this guy. So the whole time, Robert Downey Jr. has just been like plain dumb for no reason at all. Like, just pretending he doesn't know the answers to Thane and is acting stressed about something he doesn't need to be stressed about because he's already like talked to the writer of Time magazine. Like, what is the point of all of his actions leading up to this moment other than to just have a character turn and to suddenly present him as a different guy and to have this aide look at him differently? Like, it just feels so dumb.
Yeah. it's one of those things where I get if he was acting like a little different in public. Maybe it's the DC game where you always have to be presenting yourself one way just because you don't know who the aide's going to talk to. But so. if that's the case, shouldn't that context like be there? I think that's one of my issues with Nolan too, is that I feel like he's often reliant on, and it's a big complaint I have in about movies in general. I've talked about it with Argo, not on the podcast, but Argo, the main guy is this government guy. Is he CIA? Is he FBI? He's some agent, and he has to go and save American citizens that are stuck over, I forget what country, in the middle, Afghanistan, in the, or Iran or Iraq, in the 70s or 80s, mm-hmm. and has to go over there, like, coach them. But his personal story involves always being away from his family, and he wants to spend more time with his son. And he keeps like talking about how he misses his son and wants to get back to his family and maybe he'll retire after this. His son, who's the core emotional driver for this character, is in 53 seconds of the movie. Mm-hmm. I've counted 53 seconds of the movie, or 43. I think it's less than 45 seconds. They have one phone call and the movie ends with him returning home. And we're supposed to feel excitement that he's now going to get to spend time with his family. And it's like, you're relying on the fact that audiences just care in general about people being able to spend time with their family. Like, we don't necessarily care about this guy's relationship with this kid.
I hate spending time with my family.
You're right. Oh, what a horrible thing. I wish that for no one. It's just the generic emotion that they're counting on us having rather than this earned reunion between these two characters. And I feel like that's something that Nolan often relies on, is the generic emotion rather than the earned thing. So it's like Hill and everything with Hill, like coming in and delivering that and like, see, he's actually good. Like, did Hill earn that? Where did he get the information? Strauss being like this evil of a person, did he earn that? I guess so, maybe, but we only really find out that he's this evil person in like 30 seconds of backstory. Mm-hmm. So now he's the villain of the movie in some ways, but do we really care? It's just a generic villain.
Yeah. If there's one thing I know about Chris, I want to explore this for one second. Like, movies are all about math. And Argo has a 45-second scene. Like, that's not enough. I'm with you, though. Like, and I think that does kind of encapsulate what's wrong with something like Oppenheimer. Is like that 45 seconds in Argo, if that scene was done really, really well, I'd buy it. I'd be game. Like, I think that would be enough foundation for me for it to be like the thrust and crux of the movie. Like, I would be invested. It isn't done that well. I hate Argo. And none of the scenes in Oppenheimer are done that well. Like, we've talked about so many of the scenes that are supposed to have this monumentous impact. Is it momentous? Is monumentous even a word?
Monumentous is not a word. It's an impressive.
I'm gonna make it a word.
Yeah, it's an impressive, like,
monumental
fission of momentous and monumental and fusion of them. You Absolutely. Divided them and then you combined them.
See, I gave more meaning to those words than Oppenheimer ever did.
It's true. That's factual.
It's never there. Like, it's just, I don't know. Now we're just like two guys complaining about things we don't like about. Like, everyone seems to like it, and that's great. I've just never been in that camp.
No. And I do get the appeal in terms of it is something you don't see depicted on screen a lot. You are getting great performances. There are visuals that are there. I mean, the visuals exist.
And I saw the movie. They're there.
It feels different than your standard movie. And it's a little, I would say, mm-hmm. that Nolan's more competent than your average filmmaker.
For sure.
And given that and the fact that he does have such like a style about him that you don't get from other filmmakers, I get why there's an appeal. There's a taste factor there that resonates with people. I get why people like it. I just don't.
That is the big thing that sets him apart. And I don't even, it's intangible. Like, I don't even know how to define it, but every shot in his movie feels important. Like, you are wandering into, like, what a situation you get to be a part of right here. You know, like, have you ever seen anything like this? Even if it's just two dudes talking in a classroom, you know? Like, his movie always has that tenor. But to me, like, that's not an aesthetic. Like, in my mind, like, that doesn't mean anything to me, especially if it's not grabbing me in the first place. If there's not some visual language to the movie that's, like, pointing towards something greater, like, all of those important shots just, like, kind of begin to cancel each other out, you know? And I've just never been able to, like, look at movies the same way as everyone else seems to look at his movies.
Yeah. I think it's just that factor of, because there's that sense of importance, you come away with feeling like you experienced something. And I mean, often he's taking on interesting subject matter, and
yeah, and people probably do feel things. Like, it's purely a matter of taste and, like, what moves you in a movie.
Yeah, and it's just not what I want.
Yeah. So that's that. Deal with it.
Yeah. Barbenheimer concluded.
All right, Chris. I have a twist I'd like to present this episode.
Yeah.
I would like to rank this movie.
Oh, okay. Even though you just got rid of your rankings.
But I'm bringing them back.
Okay, just for this.
No, I'm bringing them back all together.
What? Okay.
I'm doing it. I want to keep it a thing.
Okay.
Although I do have to update my list a little bit. Right now it's at 421 movies. I think it's probably up to like 430 by now.
Damn.
All right. And this list, by the way, is we've been ranking every movie we've watched since the start of 2022. And so every time we do an episode, we're going to put the movie we watched into those rankings.
Yes. So what do you got?
For 420 movies, and there are 10 different sections for me, and the fourth to lowest section is the not for me section. That's where Oppenheimer belongs in my mind. Like, I don't think it's terrible. Like, it's doing things I don't like, and that's more of what it is in my book. Like, it's just not grabbing me in the way I need a movie to grab me. But I don't think it's bad. So I have it, like, on the higher end of this section of the ranking. So it's in, like, the 375 region out of 430.
Ooh. Okay. So low, but not as low as it goes.
Not down at the bottom.
This is going to be a bit of whiplash. For as much as I, like, trashed this movie throughout the podcast, I have it at number 64 of 146.
Do you not like a lot of movies?
It's more so that I have complaints about this, but, like, my categories go, like, really not for me, not quite, almost, neutral, and positives. And the positives of Oppenheimer, from the performances to the fact that it is covering such, like, a huge story, mm-hmm. and has so many, like, pieces and parts. I do still really like scope and scale. So there's still a respect factor that I have for the undertaking of this movie. To where, as much as I want to tear it down a little bit, I still think overall that the positives outweigh the negatives, in my opinion.
And the positives would be?
Just the performances, like, yeah. Capturing something that's, like, telling a story that's this momentous and kind of looking at the beginning, middle, and end of it and going through this guy's life and how his life was so strongly the story of this weapons creation.
Yeah.
And then all the stuff with oh my God, why do I keep not saying that right?
Sounds like you're trying to say the Babadook.
I know. With the now I've become death, destroyer of worlds speech and like the duty and the theme of that is fascinating enough to me that I would still rank it over some of the things that I may have liked more. I would have had less complaints about, but I feel like they had lower ceilings. So this is mostly just because it's going for so much, it scores a few more points for me.
Okay. And where is it on your 2023 rankings?
2023 rankings, it is at number 13 of 30.
Okay.
So, like, you know, all time I have it above The Whale and Insomnia and You Hurt My Feelings.
Okay.
It's like, and then it's just below Dead Reckoning Part 1, Fast and Furious 6, and the Super Mario Brothers movie. So it's like, I'm still putting the Super Mario Brothers movie over Oppenheimer and Blackberry over Oppenheimer. But when I'm comparing Oppenheimer to like Air and Cocaine Bear, it's doing a little bit more.
Wow. I am truly surprised by this. Because it sounds like you hated it a lot more than I did, but you have it at 13 out of 30. I have it at 21 out of 25.
Yeah. I mean, because at the bottom of my list, it's like White Men Can't Jump, Asteroid City, The Flash, Transformers Rise of the Beasts, 65, You People, Ant-Man and the Wasp, Quantumania. Like, those to me are movies that have very little in the way of redeeming qualities. Where, as much as I have complaints about Oppenheimer, there are still like redeeming qualities to the movie, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Fair enough. Yeah. So mine's from the fifth from the bottom, though.
Yeah. What do you have at the very bottom?
Past that, it's White Men Can't Jump, then You People, then The Pale Blue Eye, then I'm kind of scared to say the last one because I think you liked it. Everyone likes it. I mean, it's no surprise. My bottom ranked movie is Dungeons and Dragons.
Oh yeah, I forgot to rank Dungeons and Dragons. Was that 2022, wasn't it?
I believe it came out this year.
Oh my god. Yeah, 2023. Yeah. I liked it. I get it though.
Okay. People really seem to love that movie in a way that I always kind of shy away from saying, like, I hated it. I had no fun watching it.
I thought you would like it.
No.
Like, Dungeons and Dragons would be number 16 for me.
Oh, wow. Below Oppenheimer.
Yeah.
I don't get you, Chris.
Yeah. Below Oppenheimer.
All right. Fair enough.
Scope and scale, Travis. Scope and scale.
Sure, sure. Yeah.
Yeah. I think I like Dungeons and Dragons more than Cocaine Bear. We'll see.
It's the eternal question.
It's something everybody wrestles with at some point in their lives.
We all know when we have that moment.
Dungeons and Dragons or Cocaine Bear. What a job.
Okay. Is that it?
Yeah.
All right. So this has been the suspense of the whole Barbenheimer special here. Like, which one did you like better?
Barbie.
Barbie.
It's just not even close.
It really isn't that close.
It's very, very much not close in any way, shape, or form.
And we agreed that Barbie isn't like a perfect movie or anything. Like, it has flaws, but like, it is a little bit night and day.
Yeah. I'm actually trying to decide if I put Barbie over Across the Spider-Verse.
Oh, wow.
I think I'm going to end up doing that.
Nice. I mean, I haven't seen Across the Spider-Verse, but I would assume I'd do that.
Yeah. Okay. Well, then Vanilla Sky next time?
Yeah, let's talk about Vanilla Sky.
Okay, beautiful. That one, I feel like we're going to have
disagreements. Okay. I have very much fun of that movie.
Of course.
I remember enjoying it. I got to watch it again, though.
Okay. Well then, until next time.
Bye-bye.